You're listening to Something Weird. I'm Brooke, and this is Anna.
Hello. Here you'll find a semi-regular dialogue on all things paranormal, or even just a little bit weird. We're lifelong friends who have had an affinity for the strange since we first met, and now we're here to lurk among the weirdness with you.
So each week, one of us will dig into a paranormal tale as we ponder the question, do we want to believe? And it is my turn this week.
Yes.
And Anna, I have kind of a treat for you, but also not a treat because it's a pretty rough one. But I'm bringing it back home to Tacoma, Washington.
Ooh.
Yes. Okay. I know I've had this one just on a running list of things I've been interested in. And I felt like I needed to go home for a little bit. Mm. Go to Tacoma.
It's a good place.
It is. But not in 1947, and that's because in 1947 in Tacoma, Washington, Bertha and Beverly Klutt, I believe is how you pronounce their last name, were brutally murdered by Jake Bird after they found him in their home attempting to steal from Bertha's purse. After Bird's conviction, he admitted to a total of 44 additional murders throughout his life. Yep.
Wait, how have we not heard of him?
I know. I had never heard of him. And he just came up. So I found this story on Ranker, of course, because I love Ranker. And I just put in like Washington paranormal just to see what came up. And he was one of the top stories. And then I ended up finding a bunch of articles on like local South Sound news outlets. I'd never heard of him ever.
You know, I have never heard. And you know, I mean, we know so much of the history of, you know, these serial killers, or at least we thought we did. But I mean, yeah. even on like any other podcasts or shows, he's never come up. So.
No, and 44 murders. That's what he admitted to. But still significant.
Yeah.
So his story, the numbers alone are shocking, and it was a very gruesome murder that took place. But this murder actually became a piece of a much larger story. And today, Jake Bird is best known for placing what is referred to as the Bird Hex on those that were connected to his case during the final statement of his trial. And creepily enough, several people have actually died because of the hex. And some of them within just weeks of Bird's sentencing.
Wait, how do they know it's because of the hex?
Well, they don't, but he put a hex on people, and then within a week, people are starting to drop dead.
I thought maybe it was so specific, though, that there was no arguing. Like he said a specific hex, like, you're going to get your head chopped off.
No. Okay. I'll tell you what I know. That would be probably a little bit easier for us to talk about. But I will tell you the hex in a moment. Once people started dying, we have to ask the question, what exactly did Jake Bird do? And did he have any sort of mystical or power or mysterious powers that would lead him to be able to place a hex on his enemies? And there are still a lot of questions that surround the deaths of those under his hex. I'm going to tell you a little bit about his criminal life. So before we jump into the actual crime, I want to give you a little bit of background on Jake Bird and who he is and kind of how he got started down this horrendous road that he went down. He was born in Louisiana in 1901, and like most violent criminals, had a pretty rough upbringing. He had a bad situation at home with his parents and those that were raising him, which eventually forced him to leave home at the age of 19. And he decided that he would seek his fortune by riding the rails of America because there was still a lot of construction along the Transcontinental Railroad at the time. And I tried looking into his background a little bit more, like any childhood trauma specific or anything about like his relationship with his family. But I couldn't find anything substantial, only that his life was troubled and that he needed to leave. And so he did. So during his time on the rails, he would kind of fit this stereotypical hobo, like whatever you want to call that. Like he literally was the definition of that, which I actually looked into as to whether or not that's an offensive term or like PC. And apparently it is PC because it's very specific to like, I don't know. It apparently isn't an offensive word. And I was surprised to hear that. You're such a hobo. I mean, I guess it depends on the context that you're using it, but he was a stereotypical hobo and he would sneak onto train cars and then would hop off whenever they reached a certain town. So as he was just like hopping on and off, going into all these random towns across mostly the Northwest, he would sign himself up to be like a manual laborer, and specifically a Gandhi dancer, which I had never heard of before.
What?
A Gandhi dancer.
Oh, man. Nope.
A Gandhi dancer. I was really intrigued when I saw this term, so of course I Googled it. And all it is a person that lays and maintains railroad tracks. So, I don't know.
So disappointing.
I know. You can't have a name like Gandhi Dancer and not have more fun.
What is, I mean, where does that even come from, though?
I'm pulling up the Wikipedia page right now. There is so little understanding of the origin of the term, it's impossible to know when it when it came to be. Or I have no idea.
It's kind of though, like, hopefully, I just love hearing when people say sneagling around or like sneagled over there, because I mean, I'm pretty sure it's probably just your mom and maybe Luke Matson. Luke,
yeah.
I still use that as an actual verb.
Oh, me too. Just I feel like we created that term and I'm proud of us for doing that. Okay. Anyway, so he's a Gandhi dancer, which is nothing gross.
It's, I know. I don't exactly know what I envisioned, but it wasn't that.
Yeah. He just builds rail tracks. What he would do, he would hop off out of town. He would get a job as a Gandhi dancer. He would get paid, have a nice warm sleep that night, and then hop on another train and just start the process over and over. So that was his life. And he wasn't known for much any place that he went. In an article I was reading, they said he was, quote, otherwise unremarkable wherever he went. But he would change when he would eventually reach the end of the line in Tacoma, which we know, of course, is the city of destiny. Which I think is so funny that Tacoma was the end of this rail line and like was this big, you know, city of destiny. You'll like Tacoma, all of this. And it was supposed to be Seattle, and then it just wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you know that, actually the whole city is wired to power like a city the size of Tokyo?
Really?
Mm-hmm. Like it is prepared for that much industry.
Wow.
Jokes on us, because that never happened. But
it's not gonna happen. Although I'm kind of grateful. I'm glad that it's not Seattle.
Yeah. Seattle's the worst.
Maybe it wasn't quite the city of destiny, but Tacoma, we still love you. It's okay. So we're going to fast forward to 1947. So he is 46 years old. And this is the night of October 30th, 1947. So right before Halloween.
Halloween.
Bert is 46 at the time, and while in Tacoma, he was looking for work and came across the home of Bertha Klutt and her daughter, Beverly June. You can actually still go to the house. It's still standing, and it's at 1007 South 21st Street. So it's just right on 21st. We could go.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's like a 10-minute drive, maybe.
Yeah, we should probably stop by.
Give it a little drive-by hello. Oh, that's still just so mind-blowing, because you know, we like Ted Bundy is such a huge prolific murderer in our area, and everyone talks about him, but
not this guy. There is something, I guess you could say, unique about his particular case, which I'll get to, which might be why this is looked at or covered differently than others in the past, but we'll get there.
Okay.
So again, it's October 30th. It's nighttime. Jake Bird is walking up and down South 21st Street, and he comes across the home of Bertha and Beverly Klett. And he decides to burglarize the home. So he goes inside and he's armed himself with an axe. And Bird snuck in through the back door of the home and entered into the Klett's bedroom. He stole $1.50, like $1.50, from Klett's purse and claimed that he was in the process of leaving the home until he discovered Bertha was standing behind him. An alleged physical altercation took place. Again, this is according to Jake Bird.
Okay.
Get into a physical altercation, which ended in Bird killing Klett with the axe. And when Beverly, her daughter, heard the commotion and the screaming, she went in to investigate, and she too was murdered by Bird. So you have a mother and daughter hacked by an axe in their home. And of course, the screams coming from the house during the attack alarmed the neighbors. So the neighbors proceeded to call the police. After the police were called, two officers arrived at the scene, and they found Bird covered in blood, still holding a knife, according to the police report. And I cannot figure out why or when the weapon went from an axe to a knife, but this is what the reports say.
Okay.
And he's holding the knife as he runs from the scene. They were able to corner him, and of course, he attacked, trying to get away. And one of the officers was slashed in the hand while the other was stabbed in the shoulder. But despite their injuries, the officers managed to tackle Bird and handcuff him. And he was taken directly to the hospital for his injuries and then delivered to the Old City Hall jail cells.
Okay, so that's a wild rumpus.
Yes, that's the crime that gets him. So this is where he's caught.
Are you shitting me? $1.50? And why was she just standing behind him?
That's according to Bird, though. Like, we only know what happened in the house based off of his word. So
true.
Who knows what actually went down in that house?
Yeah, true.
Unfortunately, he's the only information we have. So once he's actually arrested, this is where things, I mean, obviously this is a tragic story, but this is where things start to get a little bit weird. So the officers place Bird under arrest, and they go back and they enter into the Klett's home to investigate the scene and also check to see if anyone had survived. The police discovered the two women very dead and appeared to have been murdered with an axe, which was, what's the word?
Inconsistent?
No, they like verified that the death was by an axe.
Weird, okay.
And they were led to figure this out because the axe was actually left inside of the house. So that means Jake Bird left the axe inside of the house that he used to kill these two women and then took a knife from the home and fled the scene.
I mean, that makes sense though, right? You wouldn't want to run around with an axe.
But why would you leave the murder weapon right there?
Well, he clearly isn't the smartest fellow. Also, like, I can't, forensics and, I don't know if that was really as much of a thing then. It's like, clearly,
oh, that's very true.
You know, but it wouldn't really matter.
Yeah, that's true. It's not like they can do any DNA testing. Okay, so they go in, they find the women, they're dead. And the officers, this is where we see kind of a piece of the story start to reveal itself. So the officers were already, remember, it's 1947. They're already very prejudiced against Jake Bird because he is a black man. So they're prejudiced against this black suspect. They find the women. They're completely horrified, obviously, by what they saw. After having Jake arrested and in the van, go back to him and viciously beat him until he begged the police not to kill him.
Did you tell me that he was black?
I didn't.
Okay.
No. But you throw in the times, so 1947, and then these police see a black suspect in front of them, and they're just completely enraged and really viciously attack him. And during his trial, Officer John Hickey, who was there during the arrest and during the beating, made the following statement. And I'm reading this directly from John Hickey, and I will kind of censor some terms.
Okay.
Because remember, it's 1947. So he says during this trial, I regret to say that I lost my temper after returning to the Klett home and viewing the terribly hacked bodies of the two women. I had asked Byrd as we sat in the patrol wagon why he murdered the two women. He said he didn't do it. I asked him who did it then. And he said it was Leroy. Who's Leroy? I asked him. Another around town, Byrd replied. You're lying, I replied. And he looked at me with a smug, insolent look. I know I shouldn't have done it, but I hit him in the jaw with my fist, knocking him to the front of the patrol wagon. Then I struck him a number of times with my nightstick until he said, don't kill me. That brought me to my senses, and we took him to the hospital where the nurse said he wasn't badly hurt. So in the police report, when they originally said they cornered him, arrested him, and took him to the hospital, it was because he had been brutally beaten during his arrest.
Yeah, so nothing had happened during, you know, his attack on the women.
No, it was the police officers that had attacked him that sent him to the hospital. So already, this case, you got a gruesome murder, you have a very violent arrest, and then you also have this race social context that is making this a really problematic case. But then it all gets a lot worse.
Okay.
Yes, of course it does.
Possible.
Oh, it does. Before he was convicted, Byrd almost convinced the officers that he was innocent, but they were called back to the moment that they arrested him and remembered that because he still had brain matter of the victims spattered on his shirt, they were then convinced that they had their man and it was not anyone else that could have potentially done these crimes.
How were they almost convinced that it wasn't him?
I don't know. Like, you saw him. You saw him covered in blood. He attacked you. Why would it be anyone else? Unless Jake Byrd is just, like, a master of words.
A smooth talker.
Yeah. I don't understand.
Pretty smooth talker to make someone think that maybe you didn't murder someone until they remembered you had brain matter on you.
They're like, oh wait, I remember arresting you and you had their brains all over you, so yeah, you're the guy. And eventually, it didn't take very long, Jake Byrd ends up confessing to the killings, stating that it was simply just a burglary gone wrong. And Byrd's trial came a month later. It only lasted 3 days, and the deliberation of the jury was 45 minutes. And after 45 minutes, he was convicted of murder in the first degree and was sentenced to death by hanging.
Yeah, I mean, it seems fair.
Seems fair. After Byrd was sentenced to death, he made a request for a new trial and it was denied. The judge asked whether Byrd would like to make a final statement. So his final statement, he decided he would address the court for a total of 20 minutes, expressing his frustration that he wasn't allowed to defend himself and get a second trial.
Why did he think he deserved a second trial? Was there something wonky?
I have no idea. I couldn't find anything from, like, his lawyer, the defense, nothing that would justify him. Well, first of all, he wanted to defend himself in court, which, no.
Go for it, man. Do it.
I mean, that's a Ted Bundy move. Bad move. And then secondly, you don't get a retrial. There was nothing, at least from what I saw, there was nothing to justify a retrial. But he's pissed. In any other murder case, this is where the story would end. He would be sentenced to death. He would die. That's it. And it's just a sad, tragic story. But for Byrd, this is where the mystery starts. After he's sentenced and as he's giving his 20-minute rant, he declares in the midst of this, quote, I'm putting the hex of Jake Byrd on all of you who had anything to do with my being punished. Mark my words, you will die before I do.
That little shit.
And of course, at first, people take it as another threat by a crazed murderer. They don't take it seriously at all. It doesn't get much notice until shortly after, people start dropping dead. The first one to go. The judge who denied Byrd the right to represent himself and in court and issued Byrd's death sentence was the first one to go. Within a month of Byrd's sentencing, Judge Edward D. Hodge died of a heart attack. After the judge died from a heart attack, everything just went downhill from there, and others kept falling.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah. And like, I mean, back to your original question, how do we know if it was the hex if he didn't say your head's going to get chopped off or whatever?
Sure.
It's like the timing and the people that go, it's a little suspect.
Yeah. It's also like one thing if it's one person, but multiple people, so continue. I want to hear about the rest.
Okay. So we're going downhill from the original judge, Judge Hodge. After Judge Hodge, Joe Karpik, a police officer involved in the case, died 1 month after Judge Hodge. And just like the judge, Karpik also suffered a heart attack. 1 month after that, Ray Scott, the county clerk, or the court clerk at Byrd's trial, contracted a deadly case of pneumonia. And 6 months after Scott, Sherman Lyons, who was the police lieutenant who took Byrd's statement, also died of a heart attack. And then, on the one-year anniversary of Byrd's death sentence, his attorney, James W. Selden, passed away. And finally, shortly before Byrd's execution, Arthur Seward, a guard at the Walla Walla prison where Byrd was being held, experienced fatal heart failure.
Really quick, when you said Seward, I thought you were like saying like C-word, like the C-word.
Oh, Edward Seward.
That's an unfortunate name.
Really unfortunate last name. No.
Okay, sorry. But that's a lot of dead people.
That's six people.
And it'd be one thing, because I was kind of thinking, okay, well, I guess it was like, you know, back when medicine wasn't like at its best, wasn't at its worst, that's for sure. But it's also these, you know, they had money, they were in the courts and, you know, lawyers and whatnot. So,
well, and it's so sudden. It's suffered a heart attack, heart failure, like not pneumonia, you know, things that like people still drop dead from today. It wasn't like caught a really bad cold and never made it back because medicine sucks. You know, it's like you're dropping dead.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
So it's six people in connection to Byrd's case died before he was executed, and five of them were within a year of the original sentencing. Only the last one, our Arthur Seward, died after the year mark. So you could argue that it was just coincidence. It's just luck of the draw. People suffer heart attacks and heart failure on a daily basis. Or it could be because of the hex. Whatever the case is, Byrd was very pleased with the deaths that took place. And each time someone related to his case died, he responded with a misquoted Bible verse suggesting that God had served justice.
Yeah, he's just like making up Bible verses.
In the like book, some of this came from a book, and it's just a made up Bible verse suggesting the curse was divine justice. Not a thing.
He's just like basically writing little fairy tales to support his claims.
It's like, see, God wanted you to die. Here's a Bible verse that I just made up. So before Jake Byrd's own death, while he was still alive and on death row at Walla Walla's prison, Byrd continued to confess to crimes during his years while he was traveling across the railroad. He tallied up 44 murders, providing enough details for 11 of those murders to be officially closed. So he is only actually on record responsible for, I guess, 13 murders, if you include the Klutz as well.
Okay.
But he claims 44 individuals that he is responsible for killing. Byrd worked on the railroad and would often travel over the United States by train, we know. It was during his traveling times that Byrd claimed to rape and murder women across the country. Byrd first admitted in 1942, or to the 1942 axe killings of two women in Evanston, Illinois. The chief of police in Evanston even requested a stay of execution for Byrd so that they could thoroughly investigate and close the crimes. So, in other words, to push off his execution.
Dang.
And Byrd was offered a 60-day reprieve from Washington Governor Walgreen at the time in order to do the investigation. The victims were confirmed in 10 other states, including Kentucky, Iowa, Nebraska, Michigan, Oklahoma, Wisconsin, Kansas, Florida, South Dakota, and Ohio.
Holy crap. He was on the move. That's amazing that it's pretty amazing that it went on for so long and it wasn't this, no one tied it together. No one thought, okay, should probably be a little bit concerned about all of these murders happening. But
right. Well, if you have, I mean, that's a lot of distance to cover.
It is. It is. And I guess that makes sense. You can kind of, you think about it now. I mean, mm-hmm. people are murdered every day and mm-hmm. you wouldn't necessarily tie them together.
But it is almost, I hate to use this word, but almost impressive that he admitted to the first killing in 1942 and he died. His execution was 1949. Like, that's not a lot of time.
That's a lot of murders. And also, I mean, it's not like he had a home to go home to and shower and do his laundry and clean up after this either. It's like,
right,
he was on a train, so clearly pretty sneaky and I guess good at what he did.
I mean, if he was actually able to take 44 lives, that's, I don't even know how you do that and not get caught. Well, until he got caught.
Yeah. Until he got caught.
Yeah. I don't think this is going to work, but I wanted to show you, there's a picture of, I want to show you, there's an article from 1949 from, bitch, whatever, I'll try to send it to you later, but it's the News Tribune, and it has the head title, Jake Byrd Finally Dies on Gallows, and that was on just July 15th, 1949, when witnesses arrived at the prison, down in the gallows, to watch Byrd's execution. And there were 125 people that came to view his hanging.
Yeah.
And Jake Byrd wrote a note asking for forgiveness. And when the prison chaplain began to read it out loud, before he finished, the trapdoor was sprung on the gallows and Jake Byrd was hanged. So the trapdoor just came undone and he was hanged before his note was even read.
It seems
whoever was manning that lever didn't want to give him the chance.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was leaning toward, that I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. But yeah, they're just like, ugh, just
fuck this guy.
Yeah.
You're done.
You don't. Yeah, I mean, and it's like, what is he? I would not let him talk. He would probably try to curse everyone.
I know. Look what happened the last time he made some grand statement. Like, nope, let's just kill him.
Oh, man.
Yep. Jake Byrd is buried in the prison cemetery in Walla Walla. His grave was marked with the number 21520, and that was his Department of Corrections identification. And this last tidbit that I found was just too great not to add. In Byrd's last will and testament, he left his fortune of $6.15 to the attorney who filed for his appeals.
Wow, generous. That actually seems probably like about the amount in my will and testament. So.
I know. I won't be able to offer much more. But I love, like, he is so hung up on this idea that he didn't get a retrial that he gives his $6.15 to the attorney who filed his appeals. Like, he thinks he was the only one that was on his side.
I mean,
like, no, Jake, that was his job.
Yeah. Okay, well, clearly, I mean, aside from that, he was having some mental issues and trouble just in general, but that really, that takes the cake.
Yes. So that is the story of the murders and hex of Jake Bird.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's so many reasons, but I am really surprised that we've never heard of them.
I know. Well, and especially that the numbers are so high, even to have 13 people that were tied to this individual.
Yeah, just, I mean, yeah, even if it is just 13, even if it were just the two, it's a pretty brutal.
Well, and just the story around it of the hex and the people that died after, and I'm shocked that this isn't something that we had heard of.
Yeah. Huh. Well, I wonder if now, though, that we have heard of it, we'll just start noticing things coming up.
Just like references and things that we didn't understand before.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
I'll be on the lookout, that's for sure.
I know. I feel I'm curious to see the Klutz house, but also feels disrespectful to do a drive-by, but I kind of want to drive by. I don't know.
I mean, they're not there anymore.
I know, but to like make it, I don't know.
Maybe the more people that know about their death, it's kind of like you'll actually be doing them a favor.
Sure. We can say it that way. There's your story for you. I can't really ask if you believe it because, well, it happened.
Well, I guess the question you could ask is, do you think that the hex that he...
Oh, yeah. I guess that's it.
Was that the actual cause of those deaths?
Yes. So there's no debating that Jake Bird is a murderer and these horrible things took place. But your thoughts on his hex, did it work? Or was it just coincidence?
I think it was a big dose of coincidence. It's tough because that's so many people. And again, within such a short period of time.
Right.
If hexes worked, I'd be out hexing people all the time.
All the time. Everyone would be dead. We would all just be hexing each other.
Yeah.
I think that it's interesting and it's kind of spooky. And it the numbers alone are like, oh, wow, he did have some sort of power, some say in the lives of those people. But my gut doesn't want to give that to him, you know? Like, I don't want to give him the ability to take more lives than he did.
Yeah, that's true. It's also giving, like you said, the power of...
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, though, it's kind of the same idea of, like, you know, if you're really a medium and can speak to dead people and, you know, the spirits of loved ones past, why are you, you know, working in a strip mall?
Right.
But it's also, you can't really change the public's perception. And so even if you can do those things, yeah. So maybe you have these powers, but they're actually pretty useless.
Right.
When it comes to thinking of kind of your day-to-day needs.
Yeah.
You're like, yeah, I can talk to ghosts. I can put a hex on someone. But unfortunately, the rest of the world thinks I'm, you know, lying or crazy or whatever. That doesn't change my actual, like, situation.
Right. Well, and it could also be as simple as, you know, I'm not that familiar with hexes or hexing or whatever you want to call it, but maybe it was something that came about in, like, the moment of passion, you know, in his anger, and he was so distraught because of his sentencing. It was something that came from that. It's not like he's been walking around his entire life being like, you're going to die and you're going to die and you're going to die. You know, it's just like in that moment, the power came to him.
A little wizardry crime of passion.
Exactly. But again, I don't want to give that to him because he's a piece of shit that killed innocent people. So
okay, but so you're saying maybe you believe in hexes?
I don't think I know enough. I don't think I've heard enough to give me any reason to believe in them.
Yeah, I guess I would be on the same page. I mean, I guess it has to probably be a combination of knowing the hexes and having any supernatural power rather than just one or the other.
Right.
Maybe you have supernatural powers, but you have no idea and you've never kind of dabbled in the occult world or whatever magic you want to call it. And then maybe you are full on wannabe witch, but you just don't have those powers.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I don't know. Maybe we should look more into a hex stories to tell.
What if you could hex people? What if you're a witch and you don't even know it?
Shit.
These untapped powers.
Might be. Better watch out.
Whatever.
Don't piss me off.
I'd be dead so long ago.
I know. I would have killed you a long time ago.
Yeah, and I definitely would know if I had powers because I get so angry that
yeah,
they would come out. So.
So tell us, what do you believe? We want to know if you think the hex was real or if this series of deaths may be just coincidence, or maybe you know more about hexes and you can educate us. Let us know. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Something Weird Podcast.
And we love hearing your stories, whether they be surrounding a picture you send us, or, you know, just an account that you have personally been through, or, you know, your cousin's best friend's cousin told you, but hey, we want to hear them all, whether they're paranormal, spooky, or just even a little bit weird. And if you enjoyed any bit or all of our podcasts, please let us know with a big old 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It makes a big difference. We want the truth and Mill's mini history lessons out there for you, because it's really the more you know.
Here we are again, another week down. Thank you for joining us and listening, and again, taking in one of my little history lessons for you. We appreciate you being here and listening. So until next time,
stay weirdy.
Yeet. That's a soft yeet.